Hello and welcome to our episode titled Enchantment. In this episode, I, Helen Emily Davey, talk to Christopher Bond, who is an artist and writer currently based in London, England. Chris's work analyses the queer body in relation to systems of order in nature, in nightlife, in cities, often creating objects and posters from speculative futures alongside fictional texts. Bond's work outlines situations in which mass biopolitical revolutions have occurred. Recent projects have included sex worker positive tattoos, queer doomsday preppers, future AI porn categories, love letters to Oleg Kulik, and musings on the form of the antler. I really hope you enjoy our excavations into the themes in Chris's work and my own. And welcome to the Underland. Which is an Austrian Association of Women Artists here in the first district of Vienna. We've been in residency now for just under a week, and our project is entitled Underland, which is drawn from a text by Robert McFarlane, and we are looking at many different considerations of what is underground and what can be drawn from that, what can be blossomed out of things that we find beneath the surface in physical and in metaphorical senses. So we've asked you to join today for this episode, which is called Enchantment. And I really wanted Chris to be part of this conversation because I think that there are many aspects to your practice, both this project that I will ask you to speak about in a moment, and in the history of your practice, that can shed new light on this theory of underland or underground. So with that in mind, could you give us a brief description of the project that you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, no, I'd be glad to. So recently, I've sort of become really interested in this group of magicians from about 1993 to 1997 who were practicing chaos magic, which is a sort of school of magic that's very much about manifestation, sort of reality warping, reality bending, sort of like quite a new variety of mysticism that has been picked up quite a lot recently by a lot of, I would say, cultural theory trends. And they were using chaos magic within queer clubs is in order to sort of enact sort of like community biopolitical protection. So this spirit that was named as Kawapur, that was a servitor, which is like a very specific kind of type of chaos magic. I won't go into all like the real specifics of magic, you know, well, maybe. But Kawapur essentially was summoned by sigils and under the dance floors of clubs, and her sigil was etched into strobe lights, and she was charged. She drawed her power from sexual energy, friction, dancing, anything that is fun about a club, really. And this powered this egregore that sort of became this community protective force. And a lot of my research recently has been thinking about collective will and the power of collective will. Mm-hmm. And I think there are loads of what I find interesting about the time period. You had sort of like ACT UP on the streets and Kawapur in clubs. And these, I think, were both sort of in political senses and magical senses, this kind of very like fraught time of queer resistance. So I'm really interested in sort of the biopolitical power of magic right now.
Wonderful. Sounds fascinating. The reason, expanding on the reason of why I wanted Chris to talk today, is I think there are also, between each of our respective practices, there are a lot of overlaps. I've recently, as Chris knows, I've recently finished up my master's degree at Tiangavante here in Vienna. Thank you very much. And as part of that, as part of the thesis and the physical work, I've been looking at seances and stage magic and their, to use your phrase, bending of consensus reality, of how we can think about magic through an epistemological lens and what it might teach us in terms of how we consider time, how we consider reality and matter. So I think there will be lots of interesting overlaps between our two practices in terms of the research residency that we're doing here at Fabrique-U. The figure or the figure that I've brought in is the figure of the vanishing woman. So from the classic magic act of someone who is vanished performatively on stage. And I found an account of the first ever performance of this act in 1886, which was performed by a male magician and a female assistant, as is the sort of classic duo. And the assistant was asked where she wanted to go when she was vanished. And she said that she wanted to be sent to Arcadia, which is a sort of classical fictional realm of harmony with nature. And I was really interested in this figure and how she could be used as an archetype of possibility, of speculating on futures and on different ways of being and thinking about our interaction with the world. So in terms of your project with the Kaupo spirit, I think that, yeah, this idea of magic as speculative and possible is something that will be really interesting for us to get into. So I will move us forward. So I'd like to start by reading a short quote from the text Underland by Robert McFarlane, which is, we found really fruitful as a starting point for lots of our discussions here at Fabrique-U. So this is from the introductory chamber of Underland. The same three tasks recur across cultures and epochs: to shelter what is precious, to yield what is valuable, and to dispose of what is harmful. Shelter, memory, precious matter, messages, fragile lives. Yield, information, wealth, metaphors, minerals, visions. Dispose, waste, trauma, poison, secrets. Into the underland we have long placed that which we fear and wish to lose, and that which we love and wish to save. With this in mind, I've been thinking about your project in relation to the underground. As you mentioned in your introduction, you are talking about spaces that are physically underground, the club being the most obvious one, and the sigils of Kaupo placed under the dance floor as protection and as sites of yielding community care, I suppose, if you put it that way, and also more broadly underground in terms of subculture and underground scenes that aren't immediately visible to mainstream society. And I know that previously in your work you've looked at and made work about biohazards and nuclear semiotics. So there's also this sense of danger in that which we place underground. So a broad question to start, really, how do you see the metaphor or the physical space of underground in relation to your work?
I think underground, I mean, I think a lot of my work stems from language and strange crossovers that happen with language. And I think underground is just a really potent word for me, because I think of both underground subcultures, which a lot of my writing has been about, in terms of sort of fetishes that revolve around the taboo or sometimes even the morbid. Mm-hmm. But then underground in a literal sense, that I sort of started linking these fetish subcultures that were really symbolically laden with biohazard signs, with government warning signs being a part of this fetish, and cultural signifiers to the actual sort of waste disposal practices of nuclear waste, and how the kind of symbolic conversations around how to mark a site underground and come back 20,000 years later and still have any fixed tangible meaning. So this kind of nature of an underground subterranean culture and underground subterranean sexuality and physical underground space, I think sort of really responds nicely to that quote in capturing the sort of contradictions of where what we place underground, the things we love the most and the things we despise the most. We place our communities we want to protect, and we placed our collective community traumas we don't want to see. And I think a lot of queerness bridges those two things. I think a lot of queer practices shift really nicely between love and sort of hate in a way, or in the way what we want to push close to us and what we're repulsed by. A lot of underground club culture always provokes that. I think you were really right. It does suit me quite well.
I'm glad to hear it. Glad that I haven't completely missed the mark. So sort of further to that, we've been thinking a lot about the sort of layering of history that exists within arguably all built environments. After a certain period of time, they will be layered with different meaning and different historical context. But I was wondering, as you use archival research often, and especially in this project, how is your conception, or how has been the process of digging back through time been present within your research?
I think what a lot of my work starts from a place of becoming interested in a sort of phenomenon, and then tracking that phenomenon through quite a methodical kind of historical way. But I think where the art starts to happen is a real focus on narrative for me. Imagining people, imagining bodies, or sort of shepherding stories through these periods that I sort of define by archival research. Mm-hmm. So with the Kawapur project, which is still really ongoing, still very much in its early stages, still quite nebulous. I performed a text recently at the South London Gallery where it was very from a first person point of view for this character who I used like an overhead projector because he was so sort of shunning anything digital that the only way he could sort of show sigils was through a projected light or a shadow, no digital projector or anything. And I think I'm always searching for characters. I'm always searching for someone to kind of speak through when it comes to archival research. I'm not really trying to prove something. I'm more just trying to find a sort of a window into it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can definitely relate to that in the work that I've just done, the What Presence. I sort of joked with some friends and colleagues that I could never be a proper historian because I get too attached and I like start to think about, you know, you get snapshots of an individual or a community, and you can get across these sort of temporal boundaries, start to feel very close with them if you're sort of engaging with them every day and you're reading them or reading their own words. You can start to feel a sort of a symbiosis, I suppose, between the two of you. And I've definitely had that in my own work, the figure of Louisa Lowe, particularly the spiritualist who was sent to an asylum for her beliefs and continued to battle and free herself and continued her practice. I found myself wishing that we could go down the pub with her and just like have a bit of a conversation. Obviously, that is a complete impossibility. Much as I would like to bend time, I'm not quite that capable yet. But this sort of collapsing of time, in a way, when you're going through archival research, is in some ways I can find it comforting, and in other ways it's quite disorientating. So sort of bringing that forward, that idea of time. Also in your work, there's this looking back in the archive, of course, and there's also a casting forward, I would say, in that you've written and you've made work about sort of speculative queer futures in precarious times. And I wondered if you had anything more to say about the future.
Yeah, loads, funny enough. But I was just going to like touch back on that point of getting attached to people, and I think it's interesting in terms of the work you recently displayed as part of your master's. It was the first time that I had seen in your work that you like literally put yourself into it, like a physical representation of it, like the photographs that became that. Forgive, I've forgotten what the name is for it.
The praxinoscope.
You really physically put yourself into that, and it was almost, again, like beyond the artist as an archivist, the artist as a historian. It's when you make those kind of quite emotive gestures where you're like dressing up as someone, putting yourself in your shoes. There's one of my biggest inspirations, who was one of my tutors at Goldsmiths, Becky Beasley, has had one of her first solo shows in quite a few years. And she's redisplayed a photo of herself in 1996 where she dressed up as Andy Warhol, like just randomly in her MA. And now it's this metaphor for like autism and having a late stage autism diagnosis. But, you know, there was just this kind of weird instinct, this kind of gut reaction to become someone, to become something, to emulate someone. I think that's the most exciting part of being an artist in an archive, is finding those spaces, those like unexplainable moves.
Putting myself in the work for the first time, not gonna lie, it was terrifying. I'm no stranger to a selfie, but it was the first time I've worked with self-portraiture, capital S, capital P. And it was a little bit, terrifying. I think that my work is often a lot more personal than it maybe appears at first glance. I don't know if you've had similar experiences, but I had a conversation during my time at De Angavante where I showed someone my BA final show for the first time. And in explaining it and explaining my sort of mindset at the time, there were sudden connections between who I was as a person and what I thought was quite theoretical work that I was making, that I suddenly made this link that my show that I showed for the BA was a hell of a lot more personal and engaged with myself and the workings of my own brain than even I had realized, definitely while making it, and for years afterwards, I'd never really made that connection between the two. I wondered if you had any similar experiences looking back on your work where something suddenly was unveiled for you.
I think that kind of protest, I think that is that kind of, funnily enough, enchantment, that kind of imbuing work with more than you can even realize yourself, in the same way that like those kind of amazing moments where the image of something comes before the theory, and it's an indulgent process for sure, because all those kind of auras and sort of post readings that you make when you align a piece of work to a certain time in your life, they're only really mystical to you. It's a very subjective form of mysticism, in the way that it's just a sort of awareness of the narrative of your own life. I'm trying to think. I think if going back like really, really early, I was going back through some of my foundation work, and I found this like found footage video that I was just sort of like taking hunting clips before the violence happened. So it was just footage of a camera that was just filming deer that were just unaware that the hunter that was filming them was going to like kill them and put it on YouTube. So it was like really, really loaded videos that were also like incredibly boring. I was making them for like a month. And I just felt that like it was kind of like such a crazy metaphor for like being a young gay guy moving to the city and suddenly kind of being aware of yourself as like someone who has sex and is interested in sex and is surrounded by other queer people who have sex. And it's this kind of like cruising before I went cruising, really. And then I went cruising.
So was it always a conscious choice that you weren't going to show the violence?
Yeah, because I found that the most interesting moment. And I'm just like, really, all of my work is really just trying to find the most ridiculously simple gestures that to me carry as much information as possible, that are like really rich. And I think I sort of hit the nail on the head like super young.
For international context, I should say foundation is the degree that you do in England before your undergraduate. So Chris, you would have been 18, yeah?
19, yeah. But I was like an early baby.
So just after we met, actually.
It's been that long.
That's interesting, the sort of the anticipation being the most exciting part, rather than the money shot, as it were. Moving on from that, should we talk about the future?
Yeah, I think what I've always tried to make my work distinct on is I think there's a really important, obviously, gap within queer art that should be filled by really utopian visions of the future. And a lot of work I really love does that. However, I get increasingly frustrated by a sort of sense of sort of queer moralism that, like, I feel like I'm being told off by people's visions of the future, that I'm not doing enough to manifest it, that, like, you know, sort of become quite, I would say, modernist things, which I think a queer utopia should be. Like, this is the future, it's up to you to get there. And it's a nice straight curve would up if we all behave ourselves. And I believe in queer utopias. I also believe in queer dystopias. And I also believe in queer futures that change between both of those states every day. There's always a sort of illicitness and insurgency in a lot of the things I write and think about these futures. There was like a line in a poster I showed at the New Contemporaries that says human crow funerals, and a crow funeral is just this situation where crows get so overwhelmed by grief that they just immediately start having sex with each other. To me, the idea of a human crow funeral was a sort of sharp vision to a queer future, a future emotional state. I also feel like very much that future writing has to liberate itself from technology sometimes, that to write the future, you don't have to write a new technology that enables the future. I think you can talk about future modes of thinking or future consciousness. I think Hannah Black does that beautifully in one of her books, Dark Pool Party, where she has this narrator who is trying to talk about her own life, but she can't stop talking about celebrities as if she's met them. Like, she's trying to explain her going to a hotel room, and then she keeps talking about how Usher should be there. And it just becomes this absolutely, like, quite tragic and quite funny narrative that just feels like the way that we all might be thinking in 5 years. So I think in terms of, like, being an artist and being invested in speculative futures, there's a lot of like learned things about approaching the future that I feel like I try to de-learn as much as possible in order to actually write something that feels fully speculative and sort of gets over this kind of like ingrained modernism that you get from like any form of education in the Western world.
On that note, I suppose I wanted to ask you about human and more than human or outside of human figures within your work. You've worked with Cerberus, with werewolves, sacred deer, the love letter you wrote to Oleg Kulik. So sort of generally speaking, how does hybridity and hybrid beings come into your practice?
I think there's like so much rich literature, and actually, funnily enough, awareness from your, I don't want to say you're everyday queer, but like, so queer people are so aware and self-aware of their kind of entanglement, an erotic entanglement with non-human things. Like, you only have to go on Twitter and like type in Venom by Spider-Man to sort of get an idea of the queer fandom of non-human entities. And it's, you know, in this kind of like post-furry era of desire, of like erotic media, of like pup play, of like these kind of like I always see them as like narrative entanglements with the other, like you know, pup play isn't wanting to have sex with a dog, it's wanting to be a dog having sex, and that's like a very different thing, and that's very much like a narrative intervention in everyday life. But I do think there's a big distinction between dog and werewolf, and I'm definitely more interested in werewolf, or I'm definitely more interested in sort of plot holes that we find erotic, like the idea of being literally like fixated on a plot hole, this idea that like sexuality is, and sort of eroticism so much now is about sort of puncturing the real. And I think, and this is just my theory, I think that's always been about sort of a freedom of self-expression, that like if I've created myself, if I've engaged in a sort of idea of sexual world building that's so sheltered from the outside world or subterranean to it, I can sort of let myself go. And I think a lot of queer people carry a lot of internalized shame, so it sometimes is a lot easier to imagine having the sex you want with a werewolf than it is with another human. Don't ask questions you don't want the answers to. I've always wanted to be on a gallery podcast talking about how I kind of want to have sex with a werewolf, so thank you for letting me realize, I would say, a micro dream of mine.
In terms of the, I suppose, supernatural figures, is that another realm within biopolitics? Do you see those two as related, that one can speak to the experience of the other?
I think, like, on a really more serious note, that so much of AIDS activism was about an awareness of the dead, a memory of the dead, and a carrying forth of the dead, a sort of almost procession of the dead, whether it's the AIDS quilts that sort of were stitched and with photographs and imbued with sort of such, you only have to look at the images to sort of feel such an intense sort of, I would say, supernatural psychic power. You know, or was it Kenneth Anger's jacket? That was the "If I Die, Leave My Body on the Steps of the FDA." People performing to the camera as if they were already dead. So much of the placards, so much of the literature was a performance art in a way that was so aware of the backwards gaze of history that it would have on this event. And I think a lot of that has influenced my work in terms of thinking about time and thinking about the supernatural, and sort of a lot of why I think my work has expressed through sigils, whether they become tattoo designs or whether they become actual sigils, this kind of awareness of the power of images and the sort of linearity of images, and sort of a lot of the most intense activism where people sort of almost take control of time itself and the awareness of their own mortality and use that almost as a portal to reach others.
Yeah, it's interesting you use the word portal. I, in my own work, obviously consider the supernatural continuously, and I've always found that I want to take a very non-judgmental, is not maybe, it's a word that I've used, but I don't think it goes quite far enough, in that I think it's easy from a Western 21st century, I would say, small-minded perspective to look back at the history of spiritualism and to laugh or to sort of pity the people that you see as being tricked into believing these things. And yes, I mean, there are some people that were in it to make a quick buck, but in terms of the the drive of why, or the desire of people to communicate with lost loved ones, that comes from a very, very deep place of grief and confusion, and that the supernatural could be a sense, or could be a place of comfort or healing, is something that I've really sort of connected to within my work, in that there are these desires for communication that are too big for a sort of linear consensus model of reality to hold, and they bleed out and they bleed across boundaries and they bleed across time. And just personally, I find that a much more, maybe comforting, but a much better place to be, and one that sits better in my head than other sort of epistemological lenses of this is the one true reality and anything outside of it is either to be pitied or it's folly or it's people being fooled. I think that there's a possibility in the supernatural that can help us understand ourselves, I mean, as artists, as queer people, as myself as a woman. Like, there are more things on heaven and earth, as the old, you know, cliched quote goes, but it's a place of wonder and exploration rather than a place of shutting oneself off and shutting off of possibility. Yeah, how do you find yourself addressing sort of these binary modes of thinking in your work, be it sort of real, non-real, human, non-human? You've spoken a little bit about sort of hybridity, but I know you also work with the history of alchemy and the power of transformation. And is that something that you see as actively in opposition, or, you know, actively questioning sort of binary reality?
A lot of an intense period of time of research for me was about this kind of quite urban problem between machine learning platforms, monitoring platforms, and that can range from Grindr, Scruff, or whatever your hookup app of choice is, to I would say more insidious machine learning platforms, or even ones used in medical use. And the contention between that and what an unmonitored body wants, and once again, subterranean. I think that narrative was super subterranean. It was about the queer need to non be visible to monitoring platforms, and how monitoring platforms are constantly surveilling gay culture in order to territorialize it and sometimes suppress it. And this thread of alchemy, in terms of its transformational power, and this kind of quite queer state of thinking that one thing can be another without necessarily saying it's not the original anymore, that blood could be ash, which, you know, I was thinking about how STI postal tests are incinerated and their metrics are recorded, but like, so that you have this kind of digital echo of something that has gone through a transformative process. This might be quite a long answer, sorry. But in terms of alchemy, also as an acknowledgement of the sort of volatility of matter and how it can be everything else, that idea really carried forward in Sadie Plant's Ones and Zeros. She talks about coding and the people with proclivity for coding, and how at MIT, the amount of trans female coders was about 500 times the national average for a workplace. And she links it to this idea that trans bodies can understand what a binary is to create something greater, that ones and zeros aren't necessarily things that counteract each other or cannot coexist. Actually, they need to coexist in many different mutations in order to create something grander and more complex that can contradict itself. And this kind of linking between like the trans body or the queer body and their kind of knowledge that just because, I don't know, a rock may become gold doesn't mean it's not a rock, or doesn't mean it's not gold anymore. These kind of very complex ideas of transformation and materiality. Alchemy has just kind of become this kind of metaphor for a sort of queer mode of thinking that just sort of challenges the kind of perceived real of everything around you.
I really like the, yeah, the things are not all they as they seem quality in alchemy, in that things can exist as two states at one time. And this is something that I'm sort of continuing to think of post my previous show, post What Presence Is. I'm no quantum physicist, but the possibility, I suppose, of spiritualist thought in an increasingly digitally mediated, and also a world in which we exist in many different states simultaneously. So even as people, we are matter, but we exist in many different ways, or in terms of quantum physics, the idea that matter itself is existing in many states.
Picking up that thread of volatility is an interesting one, both within magic and within, I'd say, what we both do with like marginalized bodies and marginalized people. I was wondering, like, how do you see a lot of the intensity of the lives of people involved with spiritualism, the way they were treated, and the kind of, as a way of acting out against the oppressive systems around them, how the kind of magic and volatility, both like magic in a sense of a believing what's around you real, and volatility in the way that like wider society view you as a figure. I wonder if you could expand on that a little, because I think it's really relevant to a lot of the research you did recently.
Yeah, in terms of the wider societal systems, I was really I had a long-standing sort of interest in this topic, and then in reading about the history of spiritualism itself, there's a book called The Darkened Room by Alex Owen, which is about specifically women in spiritualism, and I was really struck by how many, especially in the United States, where spiritualism was invented is probably not the right word, but where it started to really take off in the mid-19th century, I was really fascinated to learn about how many spiritualists were also involved in the suffrage movement and in the abolitionist movement. And some of that carried over to the UK and in Europe, but it was especially in America that this sort of more radical fringe of spiritualism existed. And I previously mentioned Louisa Low and her sort of almost heretical speech. I mean, she was, as I said, put into an asylum by her husband. And part of the reason for that is that she claimed to be able to communicate directly with God. And this, of course, goes against any sort of Victorian modes of femininity or church power or all of these different sort of societal structures. And I was really struck by these different stories and how in the spiritualist practice, there is no one spiritualist practice. It's a very contradictory movement. But in this questioning of reality and as of death as a final ending point, you are then free, I suppose, to question a lot more conventional wisdoms that you're raised to believe your entire life. And the possibility of it was really exciting. I think that politically speaking, it's very easy to be fatalistic and to hear stories of people that were so radical and did it with this magical lens was really moving to me. And also in terms of in the work, in the show What Presence, as mentioned before, I worked with self-portraiture for the first time properly, and in doing that I was really sort of questioning my own role as an artist and how much what role I was taking and what voice I was speaking through. I found the testimonies of mediums themselves fascinating, because this idea of stepping outside of oneself in order to speak is, I think, very relevant to at least my artistic practice, but also to art making in general. This sort of how much is me and how much is the work, and it's a very fraught boundary, I find, and engaging with that directly has been an interesting process, a difficult process at times, as it always is, I suppose. But yeah, I think I found a lot of power in reading, doing the research and reading these stories, in that I often find that I pull a bit of my own disappearing, or previously have pulled a bit of a disappearing act in my own work, that I'm not consciously taking presence. And that was something that I tried to do with this show, was to reinsert myself again and sort of have a voice in the work. And it's a voice that's multifaceted, and it's self-contradictory, and it's complicated, and it's, you know, messy and fragmented, but it is my voice being reinserted into the work that for a long time I was really incapable or very resistant to doing. And it was only really, I think, through the research that I was able to sort of draw something from this history of people that were unafraid to use magic and the supernatural as something that reaffirmed their own right to speak.
It's almost like it would be so unimaginable to be free that you have to summon free things free you, like the unimaginable. But I think what I like about your practice is that there are these mystical themes, but alongside of, I think sometimes the things I'm most drawn by are just these characters, and sometimes including yourself, that is just trying to break out of something, like whether it's the rotating praxinoscope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got it.
The way that figure almost feels that they're trying to break free of that, or there's always this, I mean, there was this like, interesting thing I was reading once that, like, and this links like way back your earlier work, that like hysteria is just the practice of wanting to make an impact on the world around you immediately, because it will because you're being confined of making any wider impact in the world. So the kind of medium of, like, of wanting to scream or to like tear some wallpaper is just to like leave a mark that I am here, I am alive, I am present. And I think even that title, like, what presence? There's such an interesting line between figures that are visible but or invisible, and things that want to fade away into a spiritual world, or things that want to claw their way forward and just sort of shout to the viewer that I'm here, look at me. And I think that has a lot of political weight and a lot of political value.
Yeah, I think this sort of, I've had a lot of conversations with people, a lot of people have sort of, I don't know, I find that when I tell people that I'm researching ghosts, they get very excited. And I've had a lot of conversations with people that have suddenly said, oh, can I tell you about this thing that happened like, when I was eight? I'm like, go ahead.
Yeah, please. Right.
Like, I would like nothing more than you telling me about the haunted cottage you lived in as a child. But there's it sort of more often than not, just there's this like break of boundaries where people are like, oh, this is a comfortable place where I can talk about these things that, like, I'm scared of getting laughed at in any other situation. But when I've spoken about the work with people, I have got that reaction quite often. This idea that you were talking about sort of trying to make an impact, or like make a statement of, I was here and I existed, and the things that I did and the things that were done to me are real, is something that, yeah, very, very in tune with how I see sort of my practice at the moment. I was talking with one of my collaborators earlier today about poltergeists and the sort of idea that, you know, people tend to hear the word ghost or haunting and see it in a very negative sense, as something scary or something sort of something to be feared. And I think an interesting way to think about that is that failure to communicate, like whether you believe in ghosts or not, the sort of cultural conception of it is somebody or something that is failing to communicate in a way that is effective of what their experience is. And I tend to think of that again as something that is that culturally we can learn from, in the in treating an entity whose we can't immediately conceive of their reality, but instead of reacting with fear or with derision or shunning, that we can start thinking about it in a different sense and in a more sort of communicative or compassionate sense, I suppose. Is there anything else you want to talk about before we close up shop?
No, I mean, apart from the fact is that, like, I think it's really interesting that, like, visually, like, if you were walking into the room, that, like, our practices would have very little crossover in terms of the way that I think they're categorized in a curatorial sense, or categorized in sort of like a director and museum sense. But I really like these relationships you make as artists where you kind of know the inner cause of a work, that we both have this kind of quite hallowed reference to how emotions charge objects, that there's a sort of and there's a sort of queerness in the way that we're constantly looking at for figures that are emblematic of so much more than we create, like, really intense parasocial relationships with them. I think really interesting if even if I'm making work about wanting to fuck a werewolf, or you're making work about the dualist view of the body in, like, the 18th century, that we're both like, yeah, no, we're exactly the same. Like, those connections is, like, genuinely one of the reasons I like being an artist.
Thank you so much to Chris for all of his thoughts and insights on his practice. If you want to find more of Chris's work, you can find him at Sky Sports on Instagram. That's Sky Sports with a Z. So at SKYSPORTZ. And if you would like to find more of my work that I've spoken about, my website is HelenEmilyDavey.com. where you can find a further link to my Instagram. Thank you for listening to Enchantment.